Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. If David Byrne were to provide a blurb for Megan Abbott's novel, Beware the Woman, all he would have to do is quote the following lyric from Psycho Killer. I'm tense and nervous and I can't relax. Actually, that would work for all of Megan's novels. She has the uncanny Abbott-esque ability to make your heart beat faster. Things are no different with Beware the Woman. It's about a newlywed pregnant young woman named Jacy. She and her husband Jed take a road trip to visit Jed's father, Dr. Ash, in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Megan joined us to talk about her Midwest roots, switching to a first-person narrative, and dealing with fears that all women have. I think that if Daphne du Maurier's novel Rebecca and Ira Levin's novel Rosemary's Baby hooked up and somehow had a baby, the offspring would be Beware the Woman.
They were definitely my primary influences, so that makes sense to me. They're both books that mean a lot to me, and they were both hovering in my head quite a bit. So I would take it as the highest compliment, so I'm definitely wearing my influences on my sleeve, too.
And they look great on your sleeve. So yeah, I was hoping you wouldn't take that the wrong way, because that's way too reductive a description, but I thought I detected those influences, especially in the caretaker character, Mrs. Brandt.
Yes, the caretaker character in Rebecca is always been a source of fascination for me, and such a mysterious and enigmatic figure. Many people may remember her from the movie version, the Hitchcock version, and she's such a looming presence in that house. So in some ways, I'm sort of doing my riff on her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and very effectively too. Why did you decide to use the first person point of view in this book?
Boy, it's always a big decision, maybe the biggest one you make when you start a book. And I think the thing with first person is it really creates this instant intimacy with the reader. You get to be so close so fast, and it also creates a kind of urgency. There's only so much description you can offer because, you know, people don't really, their internal voices aren't really, you know, that descriptive. So it really gives it this momentum too. And I knew I wanted it to be, because the story was going to be confined in a small space, I wanted it to have this propulsive quality.
Mm-hmm. And that certainly does ramp up the suspense and the tension, because we're seeing what we're seeing happen is through the eyes and mind of Jacy. Is that how you pronounce it, Jacy?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. We're seeing it through her mind. And so that kind of gives us the chance to consider the possibility that she may be an unreliable narrator.
That's right. And I mean, in some ways, all narrators are unreliable. So whenever we talk about our own lives, you know, we're always crafting a story. But certainly, yeah, it always calls things into question, whether it's when you have like a distance narration. I think we tend to assume that we're getting the unvarnished truth.
Yeah. But also, if we are all unreliable narrators, and I subscribe to your theory, if we are, though, isn't it possible that we could all really be reliable narrators?
Certainly reliable about our experience. And I think that's what JC's sort of giving us. And I think what really helps with first person in a book like this, with so much of it, is her questioning whether she's her growing paranoia is just paranoia, or if there's really something to be worried about. And I think that was sort of the sort of question I wanted in the reader's mind. And you can really do that with first person, because you know you're only getting one perspective.
Exactly. Very well said. Beware the Woman is especially timely. Did you set out to write an allegory for women's reproductive rights, or was that something that blossomed from your subconscious?
It completely from my subconscious, sort of my anxieties and fears. It was certainly a book written during lockdown and all the sort of difficulties the last few years, probably hence the setting in a confined space. But it really was a time when I just felt a lot of, there were a lot of anxieties about women and about women's bodies and, you know, legislation and courts. And it was sort of hovering in the air. And I don't really write explicit books about any of these things, but the fear was in me, and I tend to write out of my own fears. So I think that's how it kind of came through. I guess that's the place I like to be. I like to feel really immersed in the book when I'm writing it so that it will come through for the reader. I don't have maybe a healthy distance from it. So I do really get in that headspace and sort of smelling the smells and hearing the sounds and feeling the whisper of the wind on my back is really a big part of it. So definitely was, I'm always glad when I finish the book. you know, it's sort of like escaping from my own private hell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you mentioned there, you write for the reader, and you've said that writing is kind of like a game that you want to play with the reader, where maybe the reader is a little ahead of you, but you obviously don't want the reader to get too far ahead or they'll figure out where the plot is going. So how do you accomplish this?
Yeah, I'm reading for, you know, most people that read a lot of thrillers are read a lot of thrillers, and they're very astute and they know all the tricks. And so I and the reader, we've read the same books. We know a lot of the tropes and the genre conventions. So you kind of want to keep subverting them. And it does become this kind of cat and mouse where you kind of want to slightly mislead and have some red herrings. But the key is to have an ending where people don't feel like it comes out of nowhere, or it's a trick, or it's a twist. You know, we've all read those where it's, wow, that's a shocking twist, but it doesn't really make any sense based on the characters as we've come to know them. So I always really want to play fair too and have it feel emotionally satisfying. So that a lot of that is really imagining the reader beside me as I write. And of course, there's not just one reader, there's millions of them, but I suppose imagining the reader like me that wants to be taken on this adventure, this sort of joyride, but doesn't want to feel talked down to or manipulated unfairly or hustled or played.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of endings, I thought you really stuck the landing with the ending of Beware the Woman. I did not see that coming. If you don't mind my asking, did you know how the book was going to end before you started writing it?
I always have to have a pretty strong idea, but there's usually things do shift a little bit, and they certainly did with this one. I knew one thing that was going to happen, but I didn't know the other things. Mm. And at a certain point, you know, things start to build towards the end and everything sort of becomes clear because you know, when you plan the ending, you don't fully know the characters. Maybe you know your main character very well, but I didn't really know JC's husband, Jed, that well when I started it, and he began to take shape for him. Same with Mrs. Brandt, same with Dr. Ash. So all these characters, as they develop, then the ending has to develop with them. So that's when the exciting moment, when I always think of it as like a treasure hunt, because there's things that you put in the first part of the book and you don't realize that you're going to be able to use them later and that you need them actually. And then they all sort of fall in your hand like these magic tools at the end, and you sort of see how all the pieces should fit.
Yeah, you mentioned JC's husband, Jed. One of the most interesting things about him is that he creates neon signs, and this seems to be so specific and so intentional that it must have a connection to the other themes in the book in some way, does it?
Originally, it was just because I met someone at a party once whose brother was a neon artist. One of the last ones who had fully been trained by one of the neon masters of the golden age. And, you know, most of those signs are LED signs now, and they're not made that same way. And so she was telling me all about his study. And he left high school to study at the feet of this master. And now he owns his own studio. And it was also fascinating. So it really started as, you know, when you're a writer, it's always hard to know how other people do their jobs. And you're always having to write about other jobs. And so this was sort of perfect because it was a kind of fascinating job. But it ended up having lots of thematic resonance for me because Jed is someone that's sort of torn between two sides of himself, his artistic and sensitive side, and his sort of more practical scientific side is represented by his father, who's a doctor. So in some way, neon, as both an art and a science, felt like the sort of perfect halfway point of someone who feels divided.
Yeah, Yeah, definitely. You mentioned Jed's father, who is a doctor. Can you tell us a bit about him and his relationship with JC? Because it's kind of interesting, the way they interact. There's this interesting kind of chemistry going on between them.
I feel like I grew up with a lot of Dr. Ashes of one kind or another. Men, you know, of an older generation, they're very genteel and very charming and very courtly. And they can be very pleasing to be around as a woman, because they really know how to talk to women and they're very gallant and then there's always this sort of limit that it hits. And it's often, I think sometimes that feeling, and we all hit the age where we have this feeling where we feel like the world has left us behind and things have changed. And I want the world the way it was. And I think Dr. Ash is just felt to me like one of those men. I'm from the Midwest and I grew up with a lot of men like that. And of course, they're everywhere. I live in New York now, and I know these men too. But there's a particular, you know, Midwestern tend to be friendlier people, at least outwardly, as a Midwesterner, I can say that. And I think it's particularly can be misleading because there is such a friendly quality. And Dr. Ash is a pretty complicated person, but I think his friendliness is in some ways just the very first layer that you reach, and you don't know what else is beneath it. So he's a sort of shifter in that way.
Yes, very much so. Very well said. And you mentioned being from the Midwest, and that was one of the interesting things, one of many interesting things about Beware the Woman, is that it's set in your home state of Michigan.
Yes, I rarely have done that. I grew up, you know, in Detroit, which is very far from the Upper Peninsula where the book is set, but you always end up going there as a kid on school trips, or you go to Mackinac Island and maybe you dip into the Upper Peninsula. And it was so beautiful and exotic up there. And, you know, it had sort of different customs, traditions, sort of have its own slang. And it just felt like such a fascinating place to set the book because of its remoteness, its sort of pristine beauty, and that it would be pretty mysterious to JC, who's, you know, never been there. And so there, it's just almost like entering another country for her. So it puts her at this double disadvantage, because she doesn't know the landscape or that world at all.
Mm-hmm. What was the biggest challenge you faced while writing Beware the Woman?
I would say I really wanted to keep it, because it's set mostly in one setting, I really wanted to keep it moving. I didn't want it to be. I've always told my books are all claustrophobic because they do tend to be, I think, because of the intensity of mood in them. Mm-hmm. But particularly when you're dealing with mostly one location, I really wanted to have things move very quickly. So it meant really trying to, it really meant a lot of cutting. And, you know, having things move a lot. And really, one of the other tricks was balancing JC's sort of not sure if she's being paranoid or if there's sort of valid health reasons for her to sort of stay put or what, or, you know, there's sort of this, you know, like how believable is it that she, you know, how much should she trust her instincts and how much not, and, you know, how far the reader will go with that. So a lot of that comes in revision where you're trying to hone it and make it feel believable and make her feel, you know, that she's thinking things through at the right pace, at the same pace as the reader, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Megan Abbott, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on Beware the Woman. We're looking forward to your next novel and the major motion picture adaptation of Beware the Woman.
Thank you.
Megan Abbott is the author of Beware the Woman. Find out more about Megan and her book at WPR.org/beta.
John McClane is this NYPD cop, and he's got a gun, but he spends a lot of the movie running away from the terrorists, and he's hiding in air vents, and he's at one point, he cries.
Coming up, we'll have an explosive interview with action aficionado Nick Desemlian. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.